Welcome, everyone. This is a conversation with Dr. Peter Loewen of the University of Toronto's Monk School of Public Policy and the Department of Poli-Sci, or Political Science. So welcome. I'm zooming in from the traditional territory of the Kwanlin Dun and the Ta'an Kwachun Council here in Whitehorse, Yukon. My name is Medea Alatini. I'm a Kwani First Nation citizen. So Kwan Mun Dun, and very pleased to have the esteemed Peter Loewen with us. So Peter, could you introduce yourself and just talk a little bit about the work that you've been doing over the past year?
Yeah, happy to do it. As you said, I'm a political scientist, and I'm the incoming director of the Monk School at the University of Toronto. You might know that the University of Toronto operates on the traditional land of the Huron-Wendat, Seneca, and most recently the Mississaugas of the Credit. We're very fortunate to be working where we're working. So I'm a social scientist by training. And for a long time, the thing that I've been most interested in is a couple of things. One is the behavior of citizens in public, in a sense, how they think about politics, how they decide whether to participate in politics or not, how they form opinions on public and political issues. And I've been interested in the behavior of politicians as representatives and as kind of humans trying to do a really difficult job of trying to figure out how to lead countries through tough times often. So when COVID hit in March of 2020, my research lab and some partner labs were really interested in understanding what Canadians were reading and consuming about any number of issues and how they were reacting to them. So we made a decision at that point in time, which was maybe one of the only fortuitous things to come out of COVID, that this was a really important time and frankly, an interesting time to be understanding citizen behavior. So since March 2020, among other things, my lab has been surveying a large number of Canadians regularly to understand their views on COVID. So what they're concerned about, what they think about it, where they're getting their information, what behaviors they're taking in response to the pandemic. And from about June of 2020 on, we started asking about vaccinations, knowing that vaccines were coming down the pipe very quickly in comparative historical terms. We started to ask questions about vaccine willingness or vaccine hesitancy. So as it turns out now, we've got a very, very large window of opinion into a window of data of opinion into what Canadians think about COVID. We've interviewed more than 120,000 people over the course of nearly 20 months. And at the same time, we've done studies with politicians, figuring out what they're trying to do. We've done a lot of policy tracking. So we've got a pretty close to whole of the moon picture of what's going on around COVID.
So you had mentioned vaccine hesitancy. Is that the correct term that we're using in political speak?
Yeah, it's a really, I don't think it's politically incorrect. You know, I think it's a really interesting term, right? Because what it comes out of is it comes out of literature and studies really trying to understand like why parents aren't vaccinating their kids, for example, right? When you got newborns or young kids and you're going through those scheduled shots every 6 months or a year, whatever happens, some parents are hesitant to do it and some aren't, you know? The people obviously have other terms for it, and those terms all kind of give you different information about what people are thinking. Like anti-vaxxing is one way that we describe it and describe other people as vaccine willing and some people as vaccine hesitant. I think one of the reasons, just one of the good reasons why there's multiple terms for it is that it's actually pretty hard to classify people like in real time and to do it really accurately and to do it in a way that's, you know, that kind of actually captures how complex this is. So let me just give you an example, right? Like imagine you're a person who's kind of ready to take the shot. Right. But you just sort of said, well, I want to wait a month or two. My wife got it. I want to wait a month or two to just see if anything happens with her. Like, that's not very good. That's not a very rigorous scientific inference. But is that person an anti-vaxxer, or are they just hesitant, or are they just not yet willing? You know, so there's lots of different ways you can describe stuff. On the other hand, there are some people who are completely dead set against vaccines. And some of those are dead set against it for bad reasons. Right. And maybe even they're out there trying to persuade other people not to do it, right? So maybe an anti-vaxxer tag goes well on them, you know? The way I like to just think about it from like a data perspective and from kind of trying to do it from an even-handed social scientific perspective is that we sort of think about like enthusiasm or or kind of just willingness, right? You know, recognizing this is people who have agency making choices, and some have been willing and have already done it, and some are willing, but, you know, or it's just going to take a little bit longer, and then some just won't do it. And the other thing, right, to just recognize through this, right, is like, what do you call a person who's got one shot and they're just kind of lazy in getting their second? You know, like, their first shot gives you pretty good protection, right? It's much better to get a second. It looks now like you're way better to get a third. But, you know, is that person vaccine hesitant, or are they vaccine willing? You know, you could just describe them as a person who's got one shot and they're maybe getting a second.
Maybe they're vaccine lazy.
Vaccine lazy, you know, and actually, you know, like, we can't actually underestimate the laziness in this, right? Like, if you've got teenagers in your life and they're not vaccinated, like, they don't have great, I didn't get my driver's license until I was like 21. Right? Like, what the heck, right? But I just didn't get it together when I was a teenager on something that probably was kind of important and would have made my life a lot better, you know? So I think there's lots of things where people are just, you know, it's just, they just haven't organized it yet. And I think that might sound for people like, I rushed to get my vaccine as soon as I could. And that might sound to listeners like, kind of like, are there people who are really like that? But there are, right? There are people who don't, you know, just think in your own life, like, are you on time every year with your taxes? Do you always get the garbage out? Did you get your kids' vaccines right away? Some people are just a bit slow on stuff. So that actually explains, like, you know, 20%, actually we're now at about 82% of vaccine eligible adults and 12 and over in Canada are vaccinated. So that 18% fully vaccinated, like, that 18% is not all anti-vaxxers, far from it, right? It's just some people just haven't gotten it together yet.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at that spectrum from vaccine hesitant or vaccine lazy right through to anti-vax, what percentage do you think are on that far spectrum? Because we hear a lot about it in media about the, and there's so much coverage around the anti-vax and the far end of the spectrum.
Really important question. And it's hard to know the answer to it, right? Because for a couple of reasons, right? One is that we haven't actually rolled out like a society-wide universal vaccination for something in this short an order. And I don't even mean the time to develop the vaccines, but sort of said everybody's got to get vaccinated right now in the next 6 months. Like, we haven't done that in decades. And so it's hard to know like what the benchmark is in some sense, right? Because if some percentage of that 20% of aren't yet fully vaccinated is lazy, right, then it's just going to take time for them to get vaccinated, right? I would like, based on what we see in our data, I would say that, you know, the percentage of people who are really going to hold out all the way to the end, and we could talk about what holding out to the end means in a second, but that's probably 5-7% of people. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if 20% of people are not yet vaccinated, you know, less 5 or 6 from that, really about 15% who are going to be persuaded by neighbors, by the mandates, by a mix of other things to get themselves mm-hmm. vaccinated. You know, what makes it a bit hard to estimate, right, is that it's actually pretty unclear to me, at least, that we're going to make vaccinations for COVID mandatory forever. I don't think we are. Right. I think we're going to find that at some point, about a year from now, maybe sooner, once we hit 90-95% vaccination, once we're getting it mostly covered in schools, and by the way, most schools, most jurisdictions don't mandate vaccination for most things. Yeah. They're willing to make very broadly considered exceptions for people. I think once we get to that place where we're up in the 90s and COVID moves into being endemic, I don't see the appetite for governments persisting with vaccine passports. Mm-hmm. So it might just be, you know, so I just say that because I think if people can anticipate that it's possible that 5-6% are always going to hold out. If it was actually going to be the case that you couldn't do anything in your life, ever go to a restaurant again, ever get on a plane, I'm not sure if A, that would withstand any court challenges, but B, I don't know, actually, it'd be an interesting question legally, but B, I think that's really hard for businesses and things to sustain. So, yeah. I think, you know, we're kind of looking at, the question sort of is, how high are we going to get day before we sort of just kind of stop and say, we've got mm-hmm. COVID under control, thank God, and we're going to stop mandating.
Yeah, it's definitely that the percentage threshold has been a moving target, as we've seen here in the Yukon. It was first 75%, then it was 80, and now we're at our new target's 90. So,
yeah, and do you think, just kind of ask you a question, like, do you think that's problematic? Like, or in the following way, like, I don't want to make you, I'm not asking you to make a general judgment on it, but I do wonder if, if those kind of moving targets are like, just like a lot of things in COVID where we say things with certainty about what we need to do, and then we change it, right? We say, okay, we need 2 weeks to crush the curve, or we just need to get through this first wave, or, you know, and then we change it, right? And like, we're changing it because of the science. We say, don't wear masks. You don't need masks, and we say, wear masks. We're changing it because of the science, to be sure, right? But I just kind of wonder, because I'm not one of these people, so I have a hard time understanding it, but if you really have institutional distrust around science, and that really matters for vaccine hesitancy, like, surely this doesn't make it better that the targets keep moving, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know how much it matters, but I wonder, you know?
I think it just adds to the uncertainty element, and it further erodes trust in decision-making.
Yeah.
Like, do you actually know what you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. And you could see it just slowing these people down. People who are a little bit hesitant are like, well, you said it's 90%. I'm going to wait and see here, right? Like, let's wait and see what they say about boosters before I decide whether I want to get all these shots or whatever.
Yeah. Thinking about that, are you seeing trends in demographics, or in particular age groups around vaccine willingness?
Yeah. So there are differences, right? So younger people are less seized by the issue of getting vaccinated than older people, for example, right? Sometimes we see gender differences, but the big differences exist. And this to me is the most, like, is kind of the most important takeaway from all the research that we've done, that the biggest factors in people's willingness to get vaccinated are not rooted in demographics. They're not rooted in people's social station. They're rooted in A, whether people are concerned about COVID for themselves and for others, and B, whether they have a broadly constituted trust in science and in institutional expertise. And if they don't have those two things, they're just much less likely to get vaccinated. Now, those things vary along demographic groups to some degree, but I think that for me, one of the most important things that's come out of the research that we've done around people's willingness to take vaccines is that, like, the kind of trite way of saying it is, like, there's more that unites us than divides us. But it's actually true that when we look across demographic groups, new Canadians versus Canadians who've been here for a few generations, ethnic minorities versus non-ethnic minorities, people in the West, people in the East, all that stuff, right? The same drivers are driving people's willingness to get vaccines or to not get them. And it's that belief that COVID's a problem and a sense that government can be trusted in telling us what we should be doing to combat COVID.
I just think of our communities here in the Yukon, that piece about the youth or anyone under 30,
yes. Yes.
That is definitely where we're seeing our yes. numbers a little yes. bit lower.
Yes.
It's interesting that our microcosm of the Yukon really displays what you're saying. So we have some communities, so Old Crow, for instance,
yes.
our far north community,
yep.
that has, I think they're at 90-91% of their population fully vaccinated, and they're very communal. So that piece about concern about COVID and the
yes.
impact on community is, that's very telling.
Did they experience COVID early on there?
They had individuals who were, so this was in the news. We had people who were migrating from Montreal and trying to fly in and go to live in Old Crow. And Old Crow is a fly-in yeah. community
yeah.
and very tight-knit. So it was really strange like that. So they dealt with it very swiftly. Like they,
yes.
because they're self-governing, they were able to put in their own state of emergency and restrict travel
yes.
and require people to have plans. Like if you're
yes.
coming up to Old Crow, you're coming there for work
yes.
or you're coming, like you're
yes.
not just coming to escape Southern,
yes.
Southern
yes.
Canada. So
yes.
I think that mindset of, there's a potential threat here to from
yes.
this virus, and being able to implement measures to take care of the community, really, as soon as the vaccines were there, that community was lining up.
So that's really interesting. And so I bet there's, I'm going to suggest, or Beth, there's two other things going on there too, right? One is that, like, that kind of, that sense of community and that sense of being in it together is also, like, probably related to, you know, people feeling like the community is relatively well-governed and they can trust what authorities of various types, in the, whether it's elders or institutional authorities, are saying, right? And those things kind of go together, right? And you and I have talked about this before. I think one of the challenges with small places is, and I grew up in a place that's not small. I grew up in North Bay, which is a town of 50, 60,000 people, but it's, you know, it's Northern Ontario, a great place. And, you know, North Bay didn't experience COVID really through most of the first two waves, right? Yeah. So I think the other thing that comes in here at the community level is, boy, COVID really gets you when you're not ready for it, right? So if you go all the way through 2020 and then into 2021 without really having experienced an outbreak, and then someone comes along and says, you guys really got to get vaccinated. And you say, oh, no, maybe you do, but we don't, right? We've been fine. And then you know how this thing happens. A couple people come in, and before you know it, it's there, right? And I think that there's a lot of, I think that what people don't always appreciate in bigger places in Canada, let's say, right, is that for a lot of places in Canada, they weren't like Toronto, right? They didn't, like, COVID wasn't a reality to those places until much later. So the conversation about what we should be doing to get out of it is really different, right? Because they haven't experienced COVID in the same way. And the depth of their concern about COVID just isn't going to be as high as it is in places that have really been shut down by it, right? So at that community level, you know, I think one of the challenges must be that you go in and say, well, you should really be vaccinated, right? And it's going to help everybody. And they say, well, it's, you know, the wolf's not at our door here, right? And then eventually it comes, if it does come, right? But so I think that's what's really important in that, right? Is that experience of being concerned about COVID is a community experience. It's not just an individual thing, right? It's experience within groups of people, right? So it's not just about what individuals think. It's what do other people like me think, and people in my community or my religious group or my, you know, the neighborhood in which I identify or something like that.
Yeah. That communal, it's almost like the communal perception of a threat. We have our community of Burwash Landing where I grew up. So 100 people. Wow. And we're at 70% vaccinated, 71. Right. And we recently, like this past weekend, we just had a funeral for an elder who passed due to COVID. And so it's hitting home. We've had now two elders extremely sick and one passing. And that in a community of 100 is a huge impact. So we have a couple of our communities that have low, like in the 50% vaccination rate, that are experiencing loss of elders. And knowing that we are, like, as Yukon First Nation Communication Group, Yukon First Nation COVID Response, working so closely with those communities just to try and change the narrative or to increase the awareness of how vaccines can shift.
Yeah, and I think what's really important is to let people know that it's not too late to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think we're going to talk about a little bit later, but like one of the things one of the things that really disheartened me about the way we've talked about COVID for the last 2 months is we were really community minded in this country for 18 months in dealing with this, and lots of people made lots of sacrifices. Not everybody was perfect, but lots of people made lots of sacrifices. And then we got into an election campaign where I think frankly, the government wanted to win, the Liberal Party, you know, the Liberal Party wanted to win votes off of people's, almost their sense of frustration, I'll put it nicely, or maybe even their sense of enmity towards people who weren't yet vaccinated. You know, you're never gonna have to worry about sitting beside a person who's not vaccinated on the train, right? Or at night, or, you know, these people are never gonna be able to fly, right? Like that's, you know, there's people who are still gonna get vaccinated. Like they're gonna get it done. And what do we want to do, right? Part of it is, sure, there's some stick there, but we also want to say, like, it's not too late for you to do this. You know, like you didn't get it done. That's okay. You can get it done now, and you can still do your part. I happen to think that's probably a healthier approach. than one of trying to be very censorious about it at this point. You want to put in vaccine mandates? Makes a lot of sense, right? Just put them in and let them persuade people. But trying to kind of further divide people around it just strikes me. And I'm not talking about the people who are at rallies throwing rocks at the prime minister, right? I'm talking about people who just aren't sure that they want to do it, you know? Or the 30 people in Barwash Landing who, for whatever reason, they obviously didn't not get vaccinated because they wanted to spread COVID, right? There's some other reason there, right? So why not go to them and say, you know, there's still time here, you know?
Just talking about the mandates, how are you seeing that impacting the uptake in your research?
It's a really good question, right? I mean, so I don't have a good handle on it actually, right? For how much it's doing it. I'll just observe this, right? If you look at the numbers of people getting vaccinated day over day in Canada and Ontario, where I know the numbers better, but across Canada, like it's basically flattened out, for how much this is happening. Now, part of it is that we really are getting near the top. Like we've got somewhere on the order of high 80s of people of eligible or low 80s of eligible people have been vaccinated. So, you know, there's not that many people left, but it's not like these mandates are speeding up people's rates of vaccination, you know? So I think that I don't think there's a lot of evidence that they're having a massively kind of game changing effect on vaccination rates. Right. So there's still a fair number of people who are getting the first doses. So something is getting these people to the clinic, right? But it's not like it was over the course of the summertime when people were rushing out to get vaccinated who wanted to get there. So are they working? I mean, they're probably working at the margin, right? And I think as they start to bite, as people realize that it's going to get harder and harder to do stuff over the next year without a vaccination, then I think people will be more likely to do it. But it's not like it's like, you know, another way of putting this, is that, like, if you look at, we apparently went through a whole election campaign just so the government could have the mandate to put in place mandates, which were already done at the provincial level, not really even federal, right? But we spent all that time doing that. And meanwhile, vaccination rates flatlined. So we kind of wasted 2 months. They didn't need an election to do it, right? So we kind of wasted 2 months.
I have kind of two questions that come out of that, but just with these mandates, because UConn has just implemented as of last Friday, they announced vaccine mandates for all of the territorial employees, anybody who is a subcontractor that is working, and for organized sports activities. So just anecdotally, the conversations that I've been having with youth that are vaccine hesitant, I'll call them vaccine lazy, because that's really where it's at. Yeah. They don't have any, they're not concerned about the vaccine. They're not talking about the conspiracy of somebody's going to inject me with a tracking device or something. They're just going, I'm not in any rush. I don't really need to do it. But they want to play hockey. So they're going to get their vaccine. And that's the push. So they've made appointments. Yesterday.
So I think that stuff works. I mean, if it's going to bite in your life, it's just how much is it going to bite for? I mean, it's going to work for young people because their lives are so social, right? But for other folks, you're not going to get in grocery stores, right? You're not going to be able to keep people from getting takeout or whatever, right? So there are ways. You can only kind of push it so far. You know, not everybody travels, right? So you can only kind of push it so far. So it'll work, right? But it's just that it's not like we're the U.S. at 60% vaccination or something like that, right? We were getting there. So I don't, like, to be clear, like, I think we're in a pandemic. I think it's an eminently reasonable policy that if you want to be in a congregate setting in the public, that you would be vaccinated. You know, and here where I'm at U of T, vaccinations are required. There's a check-in system. You upload your documentation. I mean, it's pretty rigorous, right? So, and it's worked here. It's worked here as well, right? You know, whether it would have worked as well as other stuff, but here's a thought experiment for you, right? So these young people you're talking to, right? What if we had paid them $100? Would they have gotten vaccinated sooner? Probably, right? Like, there's other stuff maybe not, right? You never know, but there's other stuff we could always still try if it's not working.
Yeah. Right?
And you know? So, yeah. So I think it's just one, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I have no objection to them. I think they're one piece of the puzzle. I think we should be trying lots of different stuff. Right. And I think that we should, through all of this, try and be as decent about it as we, you know, as we can be. Mm-hmm.
Be kind. Yeah. I wanted to talk about the, like, reflecting back on the election and what we saw with, to me, it felt like a lot of infiltration of misinformation, misdirection regarding COVID and the effects. And do you think there's a big piece of, like, the social media conspiracy theorist that affects vaccine hesitancy? And, yeah, and do you think it really came out of the election or?
So it's a great question that, so for people who are very hesitant to use vaccines, you know, they're seeking information to justify their position. And before listeners think, oh, how could people do that? Like, that's a feature of human psychology. We all do it. If you hold religious beliefs, you probably do it to justify your religious beliefs, right? If you really love a person, you probably evaluate their behavior in a motivated way. Motivated reasoning is just a part of what we do as humans. So I don't want to say that there's nothing exceptional about it in kind. In application, that's where it's a bit different. But so the challenge here is that if you have vaccine hesitancy, it is not hard to find information which will support the view that you have. This information is generated largely outside of our borders, because there's a few, you know, the vast majority of vaccine misinformation on social media, Facebook and Twitter, is generated from a very small number of sources, which then propagate it through. It then gets propagated through social media, through sharing and retweeting and these sorts of things. So yeah, there is at the margin, you know, among that harder core of vaccine hesitant or anti-vax people, if we want to go back to our kind of discussion of nomenclature, in that core of people, there really is a problem of misinformation. You know, there really is a problem of misinformation. And these folks will find it, right? I think it's pretty hard to stamp it out, right? You kind of have to engage the argument on the level and try and persuade them otherwise, you know? But trying to deal with it as an information problem is actually misses what's going on here, right? People have formed a belief about vaccines for various reasons, and then they're trying to find information to justify those beliefs. Those beliefs are not, for the most part, generated by that information.
So do you think if, like, we're trying to build communication material to not combat that, but to address extreme vaccine hesitancy.
Yes.
Do you think that those thoughts can be, or those concerns can be addressed? Or is it, if we build something, does it just get people to dig in more to their beliefs?
So there's a possibility of doing both, right? You know, and for some people it's going to be one, for some people it's going to be the other. I would just make this observation that if you look at this kind of the streams of misinformation around vaccines, some of it is around distrust of the process. These things were created too quickly. These companies are just doing it for profit. You know, governments in the past have covered up scientific malfeasance. You know, there's all this stuff about the institutional trust part of it. And that maps onto that idea that institutional trust is a really important predictor of whether people are willing to get vaccinated. But that's that second driver of vaccine willingness is concern over COVID. And if you look at a lot of the streams of misinformation about vaccines and about COVID, what are those streams saying? They're saying, look, this thing is not as bad as it looks, right? It's 99.9% survival rate or whatever, right? And it only gets old people. And, you know, the flu kills lots of people every year. And, like, there are little grains of truth in all of that, right? It's that these, you know, this fine threads back to real facts, but they're misinterpreted, or they're read with scientific and statistical literacy, or they are disinformed at some point. But the point is that there's two different, at least, approaches you can use in arguing about COVID or in trying to persuade a person, right? And one is about the vaccines, but the other is about COVID. And I think that, you know, to go back to the relatively tragic example you shared about two people in a community of 100 passing away, I mean, like, there, like, the debate presumably is no longer about the vaccines and the provenance of mRNA technology. It's about whether this thing is real.
Yeah.
And it's real, right? It's real and it's exponential, you know? So that is, and it's deadly in the contained form we've experienced, it's deadly. In an uncontained, unconstrained form, it's a pack of 1,000 wolves. I mean, it's a really serious thing. So
yeah.
So what I would say is that when you think about how you combat that misinformation, it's not really about the facts, is it? Like, it's about what a person wants to believe about the whole thing, right? In my own sense, is that trying to communicate clearly about the concern over COVID and trying to tap into people's sense, not only of, you know, their sense of obligation to themselves, but their obligation to others and the threat of COVID to others, is a good way. And in a sense, appealing to their better angels, right? And that they can do good by getting vaccinated, not only for themselves, but for others. The other thing I'll just say with this, we've done a lot of research now, my colleague Eric Merkley and I, with colleagues in Britain and the UK. We've been running experiments to see how long fact checks around COVID last, and they're super ephemeral. So if you have misinformation about a COVID fact check, the COVID that's if you're wrong about something on COVID, and then I fact check you and I say, well, actually, you know, this is the real death rate of COVID, right? The way to think about it. I can change your belief about that, but it only lasts for a very short period of time.
Right.
Because your beliefs about the facts are coming from, they're just following from some deeper sense of whether this thing really matters or not. Right. Yeah. So you want to get it back to values, right? Get it back to what people should be doing, I think, and get it back to, you know, whether they should be reasonably scared of this thing or not.
Just thinking about that, do you think, or have you seen in any of the research, any demographic pockets that are more susceptible or more vulnerable to misinformation?
Yeah, I mean, there are those pockets of people who live a lot of their life online, right? So you've got younger people. If you look at where misinformation spreads, Twitter, YouTube, these are overwhelmingly male internet channels in some sense, or parts of the internet, you know, 70 to 30 in some cases, 60 to 40. So you get some of it there as well, right? But it's one of these things that's tough, right? Because to try and get at it, I mean, if you think about kind of work through the math of this in some sense, right? Like, let's say 10% of people are deeply misinformed about COVID, right? And maybe it's double that rate in some little demographic groups, but it's still only 1 person in 5 then, right? And if that group is only 10% of the whole population, then it's 1 in 5 of 10%. So it's really small. It's 0.5% of people, right? Or it's 2% of people, sorry. So you get down to the point there where you sort of think, well, should we try to target people as we talk about this, or should we try and kind of go broad-based in how we talk about it and just change the conversation? And my sense is that kind of persuasion has to be society level, right?
Right.
Because these young people who are consuming misinformation, for example, they need to hear about it from their friends and from their parents and from their grandparents and from their teachers, you know? So it has to be something that's in the kind of a conversation that's happening all over the place, not one that's just trying to target very, very narrow slices of the population.
Right. In our communities, it's like the elders who are like, you get voluntold. This is
right. Right.
You're getting that done because it's the right thing to do.
God bless grandparents.
Yeah, no kidding. Sorry, there's a dogs need to go out. Around the federal election and the support of vaccination and public health measures, do you think that, I know you alluded to it previous, but that this pandemic is becoming more political? Are you seeing that trend in Canada?
Yeah, I think a little bit. You know, I think that there was a real cross-partisan consensus about fighting the pandemic early on. And there's a bit of division now around vaccine mandates, for example. I still think, though, just for what it's worth, like in the international picture of it, right? And certainly if you look at the United States and compare us to them, it's really not been politicized in Canada. You know, so I think that for those of us who have any influence over political debate, we should keep trending towards not politicizing this as best possible, right? So if a politician is trying to draw partisan divisions on COVID, is it because there's actually a substantive policy disagreement there that needs to be prosecuted? Or is it because they're trying to get political advantage from it? And if they're trying to get political advantage from it, it's just not worth doing, right? We built a big societal consensus to get through this thing, and we're almost through it, right? So don't start tying it into politics, right? The virus doesn't care if you're conservative or liberal or Democrat. We shouldn't care in how we're approaching it.
Yeah. I mean, that's a disturbing reality to reflect on what's happening in the US, that your likelihood of contracting and dying of COVID is very closely tied to your political views.
Remarkable.
It's shocking.
Right.
Politics shouldn't affect common sense, really.
Well, but it is, right? I mean, to go back to your point about kindness and patience and stuff, right? Like where do we want to be? Where do we want to be 5 years from now? Like, I think people who are getting vaccinated and who have made all these sacrifices, like, I understand why they're really frustrated with family members or something who aren't getting vaccinated, right? Like, how could you do this? Like, we've all been through this. How could you not do this little thing here, right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like, where do you want to be with these people 5 years from now, right? Like, do you want this stuff to keep going or do we want to kind of all move past it? So I think it's just a really tough social time, right? Because this thing really matters, right? And for some people, they don't think it matters as much. And I understand why that generates conflict between people. But if politicians get in the business of trying to extract political advantage from it, like, that's the last thing we need right now.
Yeah, there's some strange politics happening in Yukon right now with the announcement of the vaccine mandate, equating vaccine mandates to Stalin or to segregation and Rosa Parks, just saying no. I'm like, this is actually happening?
What? Yeah. I mean, it's so from the perspective of people who really sincerely believe that vaccines are unsafe or are encroaching on their religious liberties, for example. And there are exceptions for people, right? You can get exceptions to mandates if you've got a well-constituted religious belief about it, right? So there is a way out, right? But I guess for those folks, like, just to try to think about it from their perspective, they feel like parts of society are being closed to them, right? I mean, they could come up with better examples to explain what's happening to them, right? But just on, I'm not defending them, but on their side of it, you know, you just think about what do they think is happening, right? And like, it's not going to go farther than this, but the concern is, oh, this is the first, the thin end of the wedge or something like that, right? But to take it back to that, like, that bit about, like, you know, institutional distrust, like, there's lots of people who have lots of reasons to not trust the state. It's done them wrong in the past, right? And now it's telling them you have to do this thing. So I just kind of, like, it's not trivial where this opposition is coming from, and it's really meaningfully held by some people. I think it's wrong. I think it's dangerous, but it's not, they're not just playing around, right? Like, some of these people really think this is a serious encroachment. Mm-hmm. And that just makes it all the tougher, you know? I don't know how someone has that view, but it makes it all the tougher.
Well, in our communities, in First Nation communities, there's a large portion of individuals who went to residential school. And we know historically that Indigenous people were experimented on. So getting over that as trust in the institution is extremely difficult.
Yeah. And for good reason.
Yeah, right? For good reason. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For good reason. Yeah.
I want to be respectful of your time. And get to our last bit of the conversation here. As we reflect back over the past, I guess, year of the vaccine rollout, can you share with us some lessons that you've learned that would serve us well in the coming months?
Yeah, so I think, and this is the thing that I'm actually looking forward to the most as well, right? I think we have to learn patience and communication. I think we have to kind of patience and trust in some sense, right? In the following way, that people who are involved in scientific communication with the public and public health really need to level with the public about what's going on and for how long this is going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. I think that we've really benefited from deep reservoirs of public trust in this country, and that's helped us get through the pandemic, and the decency of Canadians has helped us get through it quite a bit, right? But, you know, the two shots are not going to be the end of it. Boosters are going to happen, right? We don't know what's going to go on with new variants. It may well be the case that you know, the kids in schools and universities are going to be wearing masks for a year. Like, let's be sure that over the next few months, we're being as reasonable and thoughtful about how we communicate what the next 18 months is going to look like, Because if you get into a scenario where you've got some variant which is able to break through a little bit, which maybe does a little bit more damage against the vaccines, and now we've got to get boosters. Thank God we've developed kind of platform vaccine technologies that allow you to develop boosters quickly. But like, if you've told people that it's just two shots and we're done, right?
Yeah.
And you said it over and over again, and you come back to them, people in some measure might finally say, you know what? Like, you keep telling me we're almost done this thing and we're never done it. I'm done. You know, so that's what I'm actually that's what I'm looking for. And that's what sort of I've thought about a lot over the course of this last few months. You know, we have a colleague named Michael Bang Petersen, who's a Danish colleague at our house, and he really worked very close with the Danish government there. And I encourage people to look up his Twitter. He's got a great thread on how he thinks the Danes were able to wrestle COVID to the ground. But his big point is, if you're a government, you've got to trust citizens. You've got to tell them why you're asking them to do something, and tell them that we trust you're going to do this. And then to be really level with them about why you're making the decisions you're making, why you're changing your advice sometimes, what else they're going to need to do. Because if you trust them, right, they'll do the right thing, you know? And I think that's a really powerful idea, you know, because this has been, for those of us, you know, for all of us over the last like couple of years, like I hope people have had the experience that I've had, which is that, you know, it's not been easy. My family is not touched by COVID, thank God. But, you know, like we've learned a little bit of resiliency. We've learned how to help our neighbors a little bit, right? We've learned where we're weak and we need to get stronger. And we've learned that by kind of being everyday people doing everyday things, we can protect other people, right? And we can be trusted to keep other people safe and keep ourselves safe. Well, that's really powerful. To me, that's really powerful as an idea. And if governments communicate that, like, you know, it's not about, you know, we just have to trust the government. The government's trusting us to do the right thing, right? But trust requires open communication, right? So that's the kind of thing that I'm really interested in looking at and seeing over the next kind of next sort of year, right? Is whether we're kind of really setting ourselves up for a conversation about how it's going to be much better, but the fact that the next year is going to be difficult.
Mm-hmm. So, because you're a researcher, what's the key question that you're going to be asking?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think the thing I want to know most is kind of how long people think this thing is going to go on for, and whether they're ready for it.
Yeah, I'm expecting 2023, but
yeah, and I mean ready for it in. You know, in all sorts of ways, right? Like the people they haven't been able to visit, right? The places they haven't been able to travel, right? Like maybe it's just that, you know, maybe they're like me, they're tired of teaching with a mask on or something, right? Like, are you ready for the things that are coming? And if they're not, then that's a problem, right? I think Canadians can handle it, but the issue is, do they know what's coming, right? And are we lined up in terms of expectations, right? So that's something that I'm interested in looking at. And then the other is sort of, I just kind of wonder, I don't know the answer to this at all, right? But I kind of just wonder how we kind of take up these moments of elation when you realize that it is getting better. You know, can we bottle these up somehow and then use them to some good social purpose? That would be great, you know, because for me, these experiences of like, we saw friends this week and we hadn't seen in 2 years, you know, and oh man, like that was just so great. I'm going to see my family this weekend. It's just so great, right? So if we can kind of do something with all this stuff we've pent up and earned, you know, socially, I think that would be great. But I don't know.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of the first plane trip. There, it's so wrought with anxiety about being in a confined space with somebody who may have COVID, and but the elation of getting to travel somewhere.
Yeah.
Isn't me
you're
speaking
safe, you're
from
safe on a plane, but
yeah,
doesn't feel like it.
Yeah. No, it is scary, and a lot of our exposure notices here are flights coming in or out.
Right.
Well, I really want to thank you for your time and sharing your insight, and wishing you the best of luck with all of your future research, and I'm sure we'll be having a chat again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, and looking forward to chatting again. Yeah.